That ain't who I think it is. Oh, I know damn well you was not dragging your ass back in here after being gone for 2 years. Are you fucking kidding me? Listen, I don't want to hear it, okay? Now, I know it's been a lot going on, and these 2 years have flown by, because when I looked at that, I was like, 2021? Girl, anyway, listen, I got a forgiving spirit, okay? So, I'm going to forgive you just this one time, but I swear to God, if you don't get your ass back here next week to listen to this goddamn story, oh my God, I put so much work into this, so you better be here next week. Anyway, because I'm nice, I'm gonna tell you the story anyway, so just be quiet, sit down, listen. First things first, I feel like Angel's death is always a second thought when this story is discussed, and that really bothers me, which is why I changed the title. Normally, if you were to look up this story on your own, the title will mention something about Club Kids or Michael himself. While I don't know Angel on a personal level, I do understand the feeling of wanting to belong. It seemed to me that the Club Kids were too wrapped up into themselves to realize it had become the very thing that they were running from. Society pushed them away because of their sexuality and the way they expressed themselves through clothing and makeup. They presented themselves as accepting, but only if you were in the quote-unquote in crowd. Even today, when you hear the Club Kids described Angel, he's framed as a poser who kind of ruined the fun. It's so sad when you really think about it. But if there's one thing I want you to take from this story, is that sometimes the compassion meter leans the wrong way. Andre Melendez was born in Colombia, May 1st, 1971. He arrived in New York when he was 8 years old, along with his mother and his older brother, Johnny. He was said to have learned English in one summer. Once Andre had hit his teens, he became very isolated. He was afraid that he would have been ostracized by his family because of his sexuality. So he went out to find where he could feel like everyone else. It's the 80s in New York, and the club scene is at its finest, welcoming the weird and the freaky. Andre thought he had found his place amongst the Club Kids at a club called Limelight. A bunch of white gays partying the night away. So one day, dressed in all white, a tiara, jewels on his face, and huge 6-foot wings across his back, Andre walked into Club Limelight as Angel, and honey, he was a sight to see. Thinking he had discovered a world full of fellow outcasts, he was even more of an outsider without even knowing the wiser. Angel wanted to fit in some way, somehow, but he knew he wasn't going to be able to be paid to promote parties or entertain like his white counterpart, so he decided to start dealing drugs. You were not getting crowds into your clubs off music alone. Drugs were the it, girl. Dealing drugs got Angel close to the circle, but he was still outside of it. It was made clear during an appearance on the Joan Rivers show in the early 1990s. The white kids were seated on the stage being interviewed while Angel sat in the audience with his wings. One of those people on stage was Michael Angling, the leader of the Club Kids, if you will. Born and raised in South Bend, Indiana, Michael was the second of two sons to John and Elk Angling. He was a regular kid in a regular town. According to himself, he was often bullied as a teenager because he was gay. After graduating in 1984, like many, he was ready to leave his small conservative town and become something major. So, he went off to Fordham University in New York City, where he met the boyfriend of artist Keith Haring, who introduced him to New York City nightlife. Shortly after, he dropped out and became a busboy at a club called Dancerita. While working there, he observed the nightlife business and soon became a party promoter. When Andy Warhol died in 1987, the scene sort of changed. Michael and his friends felt like there was room for a new nightlife scene to emerge. Get dressed up in the most outrageous, show-stopping outfits and take the clubs by storm. In 1988, at the age of 23, Michael was on the cover of New York Magazine, introducing the club kids to the New York City life. The article detailed how the AIDS epidemic changed the nightlife for good. Gone were the days of one-night stands and hard drugs. Now it's all about dancing, dressing to the nines, and going home alone. However, we all know the wholesome nature doesn't last long in these type of situations, now does it? In 1990, Peter Gation was the biggest club owner in the city. Peter hired Michael as a promoter, and he began organizing parties for all of his clubs. He would pick a theme, have hot music, and get the people to show up. Now, he got a salary, as well as a lump sum before the party to get supplies and whatnot. Michael would use that money to pay the club kids to come out and make sure the party favors were in full supply. Because if we're being honest, what was a party in the 90s without drugs? If you're too young to remember, ask your parents. And if they're going to be honest with you, they're going to say I'm right. Talk too much?
Every day.
Then you need Anchor.
What the hell is Anchor?
Anchor is a one-stop shop when it comes to creating a podcast. First of all, it's free.
Free? I love free.
And they have a creation tool that allows you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will also distribute your podcast for you to many platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And best of all, they match you to sponsorships so you can get paid.
Paid? Sign me up.
Then what are you waiting for? Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. It started out with ecstasy, a synthetic drug that heightens sexual experiences. At first, Michael didn't do drugs, but eventually he talked himself into thinking it was all right to dip his toe every once in a while. As he put it, people who didn't do drugs did ecstasy. And ecstasy was a pharmaceutical made in a lab, not in Colombia, so you knew what you were taking. For the most part, in the beginning, he was trying to keep his head clear. He was ramping up the fun by throwing what he called an outlaw party. He started throwing them regularly in surprise locations like McDonald's, Burger King, or a subway station. The club kids would show up to an establishment and cause chaos. There's a channel on YouTube called 5th 9th Avenue Project, and they have videos of some of the outlaw parties. The McDonald's one in particular, 200 plus people showed up and were crammed into this McDonald's, throwing fry boxes. The hallway next to the bathroom was flooded, and eventually the police showed up and shut it down. That was the ending of most of or all of the outlaw parties. The 5th 9th Avenue Project is a great channel, by the way. It archives videos from this man named Nilsen Sullivan, who seemed to be a very lovely man, by the way, living in New York in the 80s and documenting his day-to-day adventures on his VHS portable camera. He was amongst what we would call now the legends of gay culture, like RuPaul, Lady Bunny, Michael Musto, and many of the club kids. Michael launched Disco 2000 at Club Limelight every Wednesday night. Whatever theme Michael could come up with was a go. Peter Gation was making bank, and everyone wanted to be at Disco 2000. The more popular Michael got, the more the party monster came out. There was no limit. Other club kids did not like this scene at all. They felt like the club kids were vermin, bringing chaos everywhere they went. So the clubs pretty much started to become the territory of the club kids. An echo chamber with no one that would really question the boundaries that were being broken. The lines were blurred and the party was just getting started. Of course, where there's no limits, it's not hard for drugs to find their way in. The scene started to indulge in things like Special K, heroin, pills, and of course, the biggest sister of them all, cocaine. This is where people say Michael's theme started to take a dark turn. In 1995, Michael threw a party at Limelight and called it Blood Feast. There was blood on the walls, hammers and knives as decorations, severed limbs, you know, just all the things you would find at a spirit Halloween. The media really played it up like, oh my God, how could you throw a party like this and later be accused of murder? And here's the thing. To me, it looked like somewhat of a normal Halloween or horror-themed party. Now, are we to say everyone that throws a party with a bit of blood is assumed to be murderer? I don't see the correlation in the theme of the party to what he did after the fact. It's a bit of a stretch for me. But when the media reports on the story, they have to sort of give this idea that the person showed signs and no one noticed because of X, Y, and Z. Because you have to try to wrap it up in some sort of package that's presentable to the audience. Make it suspenseful, if you will. You can spot the killer before anyone else in the story, but hindsight is 20/20. So as Michael became more and more of the it guy, he was surrounded by lots of people, and a lot of them were underage. If you needed drugs, he was the go-to. But he also indulged himself in the harder stuff. He kept drug dealers around and had them on payroll at the clubs. All they had to do was hang around the clubs during the parties and keep the fun going by supplying the partygoers with whatever their hearts desired. This is where Angel comes in. When Angel arrived on the scene, the club kids were already established, and like any circle, they didn't care for outsiders trying to come in. Very distrusting. Angel was quote-unquote tolerated because of what he had, and they wanted it. The drugs. He started selling drugs at the clubs to make money, but also to become a club kid. He was welcomed into Michael's close circle because of what he had. According to James St. James, a fellow club kid, Angel adored Michael and let him get away with things that no other dealer would let their clients get away with. Angel lived in Queens and would sometimes stay over at Michael's Manhattan apartment in exchange for drugs. I'm sure it was easier for him to stay in the area instead of going back and forth every day, especially late at night or early in the mornings when the clubs get out. By spring of 1996, Michael was a full-blown addict, and it was getting very tense between he and Angel. He was constantly asking Angel for drugs without payment, and rightfully so, Angel started to feel like he was being used. Well, if you're thinking, no, it's fair exchange. Michael got Angel a job at Limelight, so he was getting paid, right? Wrong. By this time, the police force was cracking down on drugs within the club scene. As we all know, New York in those days was running wild with drugs and crime all over the city. Citizens were scared, and it was a war zone. Peter Gation was under investigation, and the heat was coming down. So he had banned all dealers from his clubs. One day in early March, Angel showed up to Limelight and is stopped at the door. He could not come in. According to Michael, before that day, he could have overwritten any decision like that, but not then. Peter's freedom was on the line. Angel saw Michael at a club a few days later and confronted him. Angel said that he was owed $1,400 by Peter, An argument ensues and they get into a physical fight. They get pulled apart and they don't see each other for a few more days. In the early mornings of March 17th, Angel shows up at Michael's apartment in Manhattan. Michael, his boyfriend, and his roommate Robert Riggs, who they called Freeze, was there. Any report I've seen never mentioned the boyfriend's name, so I can really only call him the boyfriend. Angel demanded his money. According to Michael, and I'm taking this with a grain of salt, he says Angel was drunk at 9 in the morning on a Sunday, demanding that he and Michael take a cab to Peter's house to get his money. Michael had been up all night doing cocaine and ecstasy, and it was clear that Angel hadn't gotten much sleep either. Michael was able to convince Angel to wait, take a nap, and go later that afternoon and get the money. And a few hours later, Michael's boyfriend started to OD. He was choking on his tongue and turning blue. Michael knew from experience that cocaine would help restart his boyfriend's heart, but they had no more. So he goes to Angel and is like, "My boyfriend is dying. We need to give him some coke." Angel's like, "Yeah, sure you do." According to Michael, Freeze started yelling at Angel, saying, "You make thousands of dollars a week for doing nothing. Going to nightclubs. Michael puts you on the payroll. He makes sure you're paid all the time for dressing up and having a good time. Give him the coke." So now Angel and Freeze are going back and forth arguing. Meanwhile, Michael steals the cocaine from Angel's belongings and gives it to the boyfriend. The boyfriend does slowly start to come to. That's when Michael goes and joins the other two, still in argument. Michael then claims he was on so many drugs his memory is fuzzy, but at some point the argument turns physical. Michael says Angel threw him up into a glass cabinet. Freeze goes and grabs a hammer and hits Angel on the head with it 3 times. Michael says the hits were not hard enough to knock Angel to the ground. It just made him even more mad. And at this point, Angel had a grip on Michael's chest. And somehow, Michael was able to grab a pillow or something. He doesn't remember what. But according to Freeze, Michael pushes the pillow into Angel's face as Freeze is pulling Angel back with his arm around his neck. Angel fell backwards and stopped moving. Michael had smothered Angel. It took them several hours before they did anything with Angel's body. They dragged him into the bathtub and stripped him of all his clothing. They put a bunch of ice over him, and they knew that it would start to smell, but they were not sure how long that would have taken. So they came up with the idea of pouring all sorts of things in the tub with Angel. And for a while, it didn't smell. It smelled like cleaning products. At some point, Michael decided to pour Drano into Angel's mouth and seal it with duct tape. According to him, he was trying to conceal the smell. To his point, which is the only point I will give this motherfucker, he is right when he said you don't know what you would do if you were on drugs and you had killed a person. They didn't immediately go to the police, and they had no idea what they were doing, just throwing things at the wall and seeing what would stick. They left the apartment, and for almost a week, they kept getting high and going back to add more ice. Eventually, they told themselves it was too late to go to the police, and it's starting to smell really bad. We have to do something about this. Michael knew they had to get Angel out of the apartment, but you were not going to get on the elevator with a body that had been dead for a week without turning heads. So the only logical thing to do was to take it out in pieces. Michael agreed to do the cutting if Freeze gave him 10 bags of heroin. He would be so high that he could stomach the gruesome task of cutting up a body, or he would OD and Freeze would be dealing with 2 bodies. Unfortunately for Michael, he didn't die, and he carried on. They put Angel's legs in 2 separate bags and the rest of his body into a box. They took the cargo outside to a cab and took it to the Hudson River. They dumped the bags and the box into the water. The bag sank, but the box floated on top of the water as they forgot to poke holes in it. They had no choice but to watch the box float away. At some point, Michael called his mother crying, rambling, not making too much sense. He was high, so his mother just assumed he was having an episode and brushed it off. It had been about 2 weeks later when Michael sobered up enough to think about going to a lawyer. There, the lawyer took pictures of Michael's body showing bruises and scratches. He was trying to document that he acted in self-defense. The lawyer advised Michael to turn himself in, or at the very least, keep quiet about the whole thing. Well, Michael decided to do none of it. He wasn't going to the police, and on top of it all, he told everyone he could that he, in fact, killed Angel. He says he did this not to be the only one with the burden of the knowledge and was hoping that one of them would snitch, but he knew they wouldn't do that. Of course, the gossip is spreading, and Angel hadn't been seen in weeks. People were talking, but no one went to the police. By April 1996, Angel's brother was getting worried. He hadn't heard from Angel in weeks. He knew Angel did not have a permanent residence, but he had a beeper. It was going unanswered. Johnny went to the police to file a missing persons report, and as you can expect, the police felt they had bigger fish to fry than a missing immigrant. Johnny was determined to find his brother, so he searched for himself, putting up missing flyer signs around the city with a $4,000 reward. He went to the clubs he knew Angel would hang out at and asked around. He was shocked to hear that a rumor was going around that Michael and Freeze had killed Angel. Johnny contacted James St. James to see what was up. According to James, he was sobbing, and for the first time, it connected with him that Angel was actually a person who was the victim, and it wasn't about Michael. He was a murderer. Yet, and still, he said nothing. If that doesn't tell you how they really felt about Angel, I don't know what will. The amount of power Michael wielded over his friends, that even in the face of Johnny pleading for help to find his brother, they were not going to rat. Meanwhile, Michael was getting higher and higher every day, spiraling out of control. His boss, Peter, took notice of this and called him into his office for a chat. Peter told him, "You have a problem and you need to go to rehab. Otherwise, you'll be fired." Michael reluctantly checked into rehab, but the next day he ended up leaving, and that sealed his fate with Peter. He was fired. Some people think that Peter knew about the murder, but he's always denied it. Eventually, Michael Musto heard about the rumor. Musto was a reporter with the Village Voice and attended most of the club kids' parties, so he was very familiar with the scene. From what it seemed to me by watching Nilsson's videos, Musto didn't dislike Michael, but he didn't like him either. A month after the murder, Musto wrote a column about the rumor. He didn't mention names, but he detailed what was being told from person to person, from the argument to getting hit in the head with a hammer to the dismemberment and tossing the body into the river. Musto didn't fully believe the rumor at first because it sounded too horrific to actually be true. He thought it was Michael's way of getting the attention that he craved so badly. Other newspapers picked up on the story and they began to mention Michael by name. Michael started making statements on the record that it was all a wild fabrication. It's a rumor started by people jealous of him. You know, Angel's a drug dealer, so he's probably out of town anyway. With articles being published, the police were under scrutiny. The police said that they couldn't do anything about the rumors until a body turned up. Meanwhile, Peter was under investigation by the feds. They were certain that Peter was a big-time drug pusher and they wanted to take him down. They needed Michael to rat on Peter. Two DEA agents came to Michael's door after Peter was arrested on distributing ecstasy charges. Michael thought they were there to question him about the murder, but instead, they wanted to talk about Peter. Michael was all willing to talk to the DEA about testifying against Peter and claimed that they knew about Angel's murder but were looking the other way. Of course, they denied this. By the summer, the police had not questioned Michael about the rumor at all. Michael and the reporters that knew about the story were starting to think he was going to get away with it. In September of 1996, Michael tried making a comeback at a nightclub called the Mirage. A party called the Honey Trap. A little shade thrown at Peter, as prosecutors in this case called Peter's clubs honey traps for drug dealers and users. Attendance was low, and Michael was leaving a bad taste in the reporters' mouths. September 8th rolls around, and the news reports that a body was found in the Hudson River. Of course, reporters start to speculate, was it Angel? It turned out not to be Angel. However, the story caught the eye of a Staten Island police officer that had an unidentified body in the morgue. Back in April, a group of children found a box washed up on the beach in Staten Island. Inside, a body wrapped in a sheet and a blanket. There were three blunt traumas to the back of the head in the shape of a half moon, similar to the shape of a hammer. Using dental records, they made a positive ID. And on November 2nd, 1996, Angel's body was identified. It was 2 days after what would have been Angel's 26th birthday. For 9 months, Angel's body was in a Staten Island police possession. But because back then, the boroughs didn't communicate with each other, the Staten Island police didn't know what was going on in Manhattan and vice versa. Plus, on top of that, even if Manhattan police had called asking if they had found a Latino male lately, originally, the medical examiner misidentified the body as an Asian male. So now, Michael is in hot shit. The rumors are proven to be true, and the police can't ignore it anymore. Instead of admitting what he did and going to prison, Michael ran. He went with one of his boyfriends to a hotel in Toms River, New Jersey. It wasn't until December 4th when the DEA issued a warrant for Michael and Freeze's arrest. December 5th, at 3 a.m. in the morning, the police arrived at the hotel to arrest Michael. Why did he stay in one spot for a whole month? I don't know. That was so stupid to me. Anyway, he didn't put up a fight and he was arrested. Freeze was still in Manhattan and was arrested the same day. Freeze went to the detectives and made a statement with a full confession to what he did. He was relieved and happy to have been caught and arrested. It was weighing heavily on him. Michael claimed he was also relieved as it was too big of a secret to carry for him, but he never kept it a secret. He told anyone who would listen except for the police. He wanted to be punished, but he did not agree that he committed first-degree murder and pled not guilty. He insisted that Angel attacked him and that he and Freeze were defending themselves. His lawyer advised him to avoid a trial and work out a deal with prosecutors. His lawyer knew that after seeing the party posters and Michael's behavior after the incident, that would not look good to jurors and it was not a winning case. So September 10th, 1997, Michael and Freeze both pled guilty to manslaughter and was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison. Because of Michael's conviction, the feds decided not to use him as a witness in their case against Peter. And in 1998, Peter was tried for permitting his clubs to become drug distribution centers and was acquitted on all counts. Peter tried to get back in the business, but the scene dried up and he sold Limelight in 2001. 2 years after that, he was deported back to Canada. Behind bars, Michael stayed in a protective custody unit because he was subject to beatings from other inmates. During an American Justice episode, Michael did not sound remorseful to me at all. He was upset about being in jail, but at the same time, he was famous because of this incident. A few of the club kids kept in touch and revered him as a club kid legend. He claimed he was sober to the interviewer, but he was placed in solitary confinement after being caught using heroin in prison. In 2008, he was denied parole after failing several drug tests. In 2003, the movie Party Monster was released, with Macaulay Culkin playing Michael. By 2009, Michael again claimed he was done with drugs and had been sober for a while. He wasn't paroled until May 5th, 2014. Per the conditions of his parole, Michael had to return to New York City. He was required to abide by 8 p.m. curfew and undergo drug and anger management counseling. He had a YouTube channel started in 2014 with Ernie Glam, a fellow club kid, called The Pew. There he showcased his art and music and reminisced about the old days as a club kid. They documented Michael being homeless and having falling outs with his friends. The last video posted with Michael in it was February 6, 2020, titled Michael on His Own, Check Out My New Apartment. People assumed Michael and Ernie had a falling out of some kind, but it wasn't addressed at the time. And Ernie continued to post on the channel from time to time. December 24th, 2020, shortly before midnight, Michael was found unconscious by his ex-boyfriend in their home in Washington Heights. He was using heroin before he fell unconscious and was pronounced dead at the scene. He was 54 years old, and it appeared to be accidental. After Michael's death, Ernie posted a video on The Pew and addressed a few things, namely, by the end of 2019, Michael's addiction was getting worse, and he had to step away from doing the show with him because it was getting really bad. He also hoped that with the death of Michael, Angel's family would finally have some closure and peace. It's hard to say how someone finds closure in a situation like this. The Melendez family lost a son and a brother, and in return, the murderer got a bit of notoriety. Later, it was clear that Michael was a washed-up loser that was determined to hold on to his greater years. If he thought he would have garnered any fame or fortune once he got out of prison, he was sadly mistaken. And in the end, no one wins.